The oneness of God to me is only the renewed meeting with the ever unique and ever particular. It isn't some sort of super above time abstraction where I can say it's really all the same.
It's all right as long as these images can coexist, but if they don't, they merge there in Germany, a kind of archetype to a master race, a super being. I'll never forget the end of the Second World War. Maybe others of you were listening to the radio when they, Dönitz, was that the fellow who was finally in command, and against the background of a Wagnerian Death of the Gods music, he was announcing the death of Hitler and so on. And I think here Jung has something fairly convincing to offer. That is, there was something here not altogether tamed by way of an image that came up out of the collective unconscious, seized on one man, so to speak, and became incarnate in him, and a whole corporate neurosis, if not psychosis, developed, and so on, that had godlike pretensions. I do think that it's fine if the image is capable of coexistence, but you do have finally to ask when there are great things at stake here, what is and what is not the way.
Yes, but you know, John, I do not think the protection against that can come via any form of intellectual abstraction about the way. Perhaps one of the very greatest philosophers of our day, Martin Heidegger, has shown how it's perfectly possible to be a very great philosopher and at the same time to fuse with Hitler and Nazism in such a way that he could finally make no distinction between his philosophy and Hitler as the emerging lord of the hour. He would have said of Hitler exactly what you all have been saying of the evolving Christ. The only protection I know is not the criterion, but rather, again, the listening in the concrete situation. And that's why I put 8 pages from Heidegger's Nazi speeches at the end of my Worlds of Existentialism, not to convict him of being a Nazi, which at least I knew well, if others, not all others did, but rather to say, what does it imply, what meaning can it have, that this very same ideas that went into his philosophy of that period as went into his Nazi speeches of that period. It's a sort of the test of the concrete situation. I would feel the identical way about someone talking to me about going to jail in Mississippi. I don't feel the same way, I don't really know him, but toward the 3 men who went to Hanoi. Maybe that's my prejudice showing, but I focus much more on Stoughton Lind, precisely because, both because I know him, and because I think of him as basically not only a good historian, but basically non-ideological. Whereas Apthicker, the old line communist, and the student from the new generation of student, whatever it is, I couldn't take quite as seriously.
Well,
even though they did the same thing.
I think I see what you're getting at. I think I agree with it. But what about Quaker worship? You see, here's the man who's just gotten back from Mississippi. Here's the scholar, and they're worshiping together, and they're sharing their experiences of the divine, or whatever they call it. If there is a unity, if this is a gathered meeting, don't we assume something about the continuity or the connectedness of these two experiences?
Well, that's exactly what I was trying to say this morning when I offered as a working hypothesis for the group the image that we would never reach the place where we could agree on Christ-centeredness as the term, say, nor would we reach the place where we would remove the term. I was saying that to me the greatness of the gathered meeting is precisely that it does not start with an a priori unity, but it starts with a genuine trust, which I think we have here in this group, that if Bob tells us about what he has been through in these last months, or if Bill says about his experience as a laboratory scientist and how it relates to him or how important it is to relate to his concerned religious quest, we receive this as we can receive from each other, never being identical with the other, and yet being able to affirm it, respond to it, and we grow through it, and I know nothing beyond that that gives us any criterion. And therefore, I would think that just the genius of Quakerism is that it doesn't seek any sort of abstract or conceptual unity or criterion prior to this gathered meeting.
But there, you say there isn't a conceptual unity, okay, but there is an experienced unity.
No, I would only say there's an experienced gatheredness. It's the point that Eugenia was always making about the meeting here. She said it's not unanimity, it's communion we want. Not unity, but
communion.
So
communion.
Yeah, so we can really be different and yet really be together.
Sounds a little like Camus' idea of art, but
exactly.
Where diversity exists, you have the home of art. As soon as, as versus, say, Bernofsky's concept of science, that science seeks to find the unity in hidden causes.
Yeah.
Well,
we're more comfortable with Camus'
yeah,
idea.
Yeah.
Well, does it follow from this then, Maury, that we can't talk about God, we can talk about experiences?
I cannot talk about God, I can only talk about, I wouldn't even use the word experience, which is hard to talk about too, but I can talk about various moments of meeting which I can witness to. As you were witnessing about that young boy in the work camp.
Yeah.
You see, I can talk about that, I can point to that, and I can talk conceptually about symbols, but the symbols are not symbols of God. They are symbols only to me, again, of moments of meeting taking place really in history. Not archetypes.
You mean moments of meeting between people.
Or between people. It doesn't have to be between people alone. I mentioned in the Thursday night lecture, I had been told that afternoon by a new school student. She said she went to a museum. She looked at Rembrandt's Head of Christ. This girl was a Jew and was brought up without even any Jewish background, certainly no Christian. She looked at that Head of Christ, and something very unique spoke to her in it. She knew there was something there that she carried away, but she told me that later then she started conceptualizing about this into the goodness in all men, and pretty soon she had lost it. It had become diffused into a general proposition. And that unique something that he had wasn't there.
You do have the experience, too, of the experiences that have been reported of missionaries who attempt to try to sketch the portrait of the nature of Christ and have had the response of the person they're speaking, but I know him. I have known him.
To me, it's incomprehensible when a missionary goes to some place that he thinks he is publishing or delivering or handing over truth, since I can't imagine any communication which isn't of the nature of someone responding from his side, which is quite a different side, and then something being there that takes place. And if we try to sort of reassure ourselves about this is really the same thing in the scholar and the worker, I think we're stepping out of the existential situation in which we live and comforting ourselves with abstractions which eventually are going to break open again. There's going to come along someone who says, no, I want to tell you something unique, and you're just accepting it only by sort of bringing it into your conceptual unity.
Well, this is a more radical position than I think I've heard from you. I haven't been listening to you.
It is more radical than you've heard from me.
What happened last day?
I paid the bill. Like any man radical.
Well, you see, this really, I guess this does tie in, however, with what you were saying about the word. Well, no, this. You talked about words in the wordless last night. Remember?
Yeah.
But it seemed to me that you were not denying that words could be used to point to the wordless.
Not at all. I'm only saying that each of us is going to use the words in such a way that we will never have the same word. When Bob spoke about the fruitfulness of diversity, I thought of a thing that I've always liked in Buber's thing on speech, where he says, you know, agreement is not our goal. There is a fruitfulness in ambiguity. That while it might, for certain scientific purposes, be good to define things, that even misunderstanding is valuable. If it remains only misunderstanding, perhaps not. But out of the misunderstandings, out of the fact that even when we use the same term, we mean different things by it, dialogue can grow again and again. And therefore, I'd like us to feel that we are and are not imprisoned in our words. We are in the sense that we cannot go beyond, let's say, Dan can't go above Christ to some sort of super abstraction that's going to be more satisfactory. And yet he's not imprisoned in the sense, as he said himself, that he never has any trouble talking about Christ or of Christ to people who are not Christians. It doesn't imprison him in his little cell, which for many people it does. And so I'm saying, I think there is a great illusion in our culture that if people could just drive at somehow more or less the same words, they would somehow be in real communication agreement and this would get somewhere. I don't think that's where we want to arrive at all. I think we only want to arrive at a place where we can feel, you use your words, I use mine, but we are really talking to each other. And that's what I mean by witnessing. My word is part of my witness. I can't give that up. But I wish to witness to you, therefore I can't impose it on you either. I want you to hear it and respond to it from your side.
Well then, if say a word that you use in trying to communicate to us is puzzling, say like Bill's use of the word form,
right?
Dan's use of the word Christ, then what we do in that impasse is maybe to ask Dan to tell another story in which he uses the word Christ, so that contextually, in an experience or in a moment or event, as you say, the word Christ keeps reoccurring, and suddenly out of the contextual meaning and our own experience, we say, ah, yes, now.
That's one way to do it.
I think this is right. I think the one thing I'm waiting to hear in this situation, and I don't know how I should hear it, is a recognition that along with meeting each other and recognizing that our experiences are not the same, is a recognition that our experiences are within or from the same universe. And as soon as you use the word universe, you beg the case.
We
can say they're all experiences of truth, and again, as soon as you start not looking at the word truth, you either lose it or you beg the case. But there is something at which we're all looking.
Sure, but a fellow in the New School said to me, how can one person really talk to another when each person comes with a whole different set of experiences and so on? And I said, what you're saying is that each person has his world view. That these are then mutually exclusive. But I said, if there's such a thing as a world, it would have to be large enough to include both of these. The word universe is only an imaginative word. It doesn't exist at all, since it means the one and the many. Therefore, we can't start with a priori. We'd have to rediscover it. Therefore, instead of starting with the assumption that we come from the same universe, we rather meet and discover, you might say in surprise, that we can talk together, and then we confirm something. But I still wouldn't call it a universe. It's a universe in the sense that we bring it, we bring our worlds together in it. But that sense of universe as the Weltanschauung, I myself would like to stay clear of, because that's the conceptual thing.
And we keep having to do this.
Yeah, but you see, I'm a little more radical even than what you propose, because to me, in certain groups, I would prefer not to use the word God, even as I mostly don't like to use the word love, for the simple reason that I see no point in using a word which I know will be misunderstood. I mean, if I mean by God, as I said, something which points to a concrete meeting and is not concerned with the theoretical question, does God exist? And if I know I am with a group where that's the only question they can hear, I do not feel that I am somehow sacrificing my witness to God by not using the term. I think my witness is greater. And that's one of the things I said in Problematic Rebels. I believe that a man like Camus can be a modern Job who trusts and contends and still be an atheist, just as much as a man like Buber who is a theist. To me, the attitude is more important than the profession or the doctrine. And I think that Camus and Sartre, who were both called atheist existentialists, are much farther apart from each other in attitude than, say, Camus and Buber.
Well, then, the witnessing, maybe even the proclaiming, is saying, this was a moment for me that I want to share with you.
Yeah, because I want to share it with you, which means I don't go witness broadcast, right, the way the Jehovah's Witnesses do, where they, they don't know whom they're coming to, and they lay it out objectively. And I said once to one girl, I said, well, we want to talk the Bible. I mentioned the Bible, let's talk about it. And she was quite thrown off. I could see that until I gave her a chance to recite her prepared speech. Terrible troubles. She didn't want to talk about it. And so the last time it happened, I was in John Levy's apartment in San Francisco. The bell rang. Here was the young Lysian man of Jehovah's Witness. And he said, Watchtower, and started to say something. And I said, oh, well, you'll have to go to my host. He understands religion. I don't. I turned it over to him.
Well, let me... Maybe this is a digression. If it is, somebody stop me. You and I have had a sort of continuing conversation about what Christianity is or what the Society of Jesus is against Judaism. And I like your you know, witnessing by saying this happened to me. This sounds Zanish or Hasidic or whatever. But then it seems to me you sometimes try to say what Christianity is and why you couldn't be a Christian. What the Society of Friends is and why you couldn't be a member of the Society of Friends. It seems to me this is inconsistent with this thing you just mentioned.
He's a great man.
I am that.
He's a what?
He's a great man.
Did you finish the article? Did you ever read it through, the essay?
The Image of Man?
No, the essay on in the book, Rediscovering Judaism.
Yeah.
You see, to me it was very important to say to you, Joe, that I think true universalism includes the willingness to allow everyone to speak from the witness he wishes and to try to understand, and therefore I didn't think you should be disturbed if I wished to put it in terms of Judaism. That was the first thing. But the second thing is I brought it to the group not as a way of saying, no, this is Judaism, this is Christianity, but as a way of raising what are some real questions for me. For example, we talk about Christ. I have a relation to Jesus, and I can't identify the historical Jesus that I meet in the Gospels with the Christ of tradition, or even with this model man you talk about. The Christ of the Grand Inquisitor is an all-forgiving, all-loving Christ who demands nothing. This man has almost nothing in common with the Jesus that I read in the Gospels, who says, you know, do you let your yea be yea or your nay be nay? These I must distinguish. But I was really asking you questions. I was saying, all right, I know that these things can't be neatly divided up. I'm not saying Judaism is prophetic, Christianity apocalyptic, Judaism has a religion of trust, Christianity a religion of faith, Judaism is devotio, Christianity gnosis. I wasn't saying those things. I wanted your response, precisely because I know that for many of you, some of the very things that I value, you also value. And that's why I referred to this dialogue with Maurice Creasy. For he and I were so close together during the whole dialogue until the point where he had to say, where he said, that this was the finished revelation. And I could not understand how he got from his witness, which I thoroughly understood and proved, to being able to make an objective statement. This is the finished revelation of God in Christ. That I simply could not comprehend. One of the questions most important to me is this. I believe very much in the covenant as the task placed upon the people, and on all peoples ultimately, to become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, that is to make real community. And I'm confronted with the paradox that in modern Judaism, it hasn't got real community, just a part of the bourgeois world, at least in America. Whereas I know that some of the brotherhood groups and some of the friends have had it. And therefore the question I raise is very important to me, and I did want someone to respond to it. Am I right in thinking there's a difference nonetheless? That the brotherhood group of the Friends of the Mennonites arise from the feeling that Christ has risen and is there in our midst. In that sense, redemption already having taken place, as opposed to the biblical messianic of the completing the task. That's the sort of thing that I was trying to get at. It doesn't mean I have to talk always in those terms. It meant I wanted to talk in those terms to try to evoke something from you. As I can talk in Zen.
I really get lost. When Maurice Creasy talks about the finished revelation, I don't think this is Maurice Creasy sharing with you a moment that he wants to witness to. I think this is the abstract idea, which you have said is not a significant part of religion, or whatever you want to call it, for you. It isn't for me. I don't think it is for the Society.
As I understand it, you'll make a few remarks, and we'll be asking you questions, and...
No, that's not it.
I need a moment.
Existential. It's not significant for the person, but you say, I'm going to stay out because you people ought to hold on to that thing that's nonsense.
Yeah, all right. That's fair enough. Let me take it.